All right, good morning. It's still morning. Yes, it is. This is Bio 241, and it is September 24th. So let's see. We're scheduled to have a lecture today, and then on Monday, and then have a test a week from today, which is October 1st. That's the official schedule. But we're going to push that test back. Wait, did I read that? Oh, yeah. We're going to push it back till Monday. And which is this? Tuesday. Yeah, Tuesday. Which is the 6th, right? October 6th. All right. Now, that works really good for people that work during the week and have the weekends off. And if you're one of the people that have to work a lot over the weekend, I don't know, I kind of apologize for that. But you got to study a lot this weekend, especially on this chapter that we're not through yet. We're going to get into action potentials and things like that. It's probably a little bit more intricate than some of the things that you've been studying so far. All right, so you got to really apply yourself this weekend so that you can get a lot out of lectures next week, and then you get another weekend to study. And I think we'll be able to clean up on the test. All right, but if you don't study this weekend, I don't know if there's any hope for you. Okay, so you got to really apply yourself this weekend. So the test is on October 6th. What day is that?
Tuesday.
Okay, that's really good. All right, so remember that the nervous system is made up of two different kinds of cells. What are the two different kinds of cells? Neurons, which carry electrical information, and neuroglia, or support cells. The support cells don't transmit information over long distances via electrical kinds of signals, but we're learning that they perform other very important functions and maybe even more important than neurons, because they tell neurons how to connect up with each other, whether neurons should replace other neurons that are no longer useful. And so you got to be able to recognize all the different kinds of support cells by their shape and tell me what the function is of them. So if I show you the shape of a neuroglia cell, you got to tell me what the function is. Like, for instance, I guess I could pick one up right over here. This one, that's what about these cells right here? What do they do? Okay, these are Schwann cells. Where do you find them? Peripheral nervous system. And what do they do? What's the function of these guys? Right, they allow a nerve impulse to skip or hop down an axon, thereby increasing its speed of transmission. Right, so it makes nerve transmission a lot faster. All right, so, and what's the companion cell to a Schwann cell in the central nervous system? That's an oligodendrocyte. Right, oligodendrocyte, the chemical that is wrapped around the axon to act as insulation, is the same in both cases. What's the chemical called? Starts with an M. Myelin, yeah, it forms a myelin sheath. So both oligodendrocytes and Schwann cells wrap myelin sheaths around an axon, speeding up their nerve impulse. All right, we were talking about an astrocyte, right, when we were finishing last time. This is another kind of support cell. And you can see that it acts, it has a number of different functions, but here is one that's pretty cool. It acts like a bridge for direct transport of glucose from a blood capillary directly into the neuron. All right, so it acts like a special delivery system. That's really handy. And why does this neuron need glucose? Why does it need glucose? I heard because that's how a cell makes ATP. Through what kind of process? Wow, it's what? Called respiration, right? And then you should know a couple different kinds of respiration, like aerobic respiration versus anaerobic respiration, and some pathways involved with those two things. But the fuel molecule that's needed for respiration in most cases is glucose. But we also did learn there's another molecule that can be used to generate a lot of ATP. What's another molecule besides a sugar or glucose? Fatty acids, right, can enter the Krebs cycle. What's the pathway that a fatty acid will be degraded by so that acetyl-CoAs can enter the Krebs cycle? It's called beta oxidation. Yeah, beta oxidation. So beta oxidation is a part of the metabolic pathways within the matrix of the mitochondria, just like the Krebs cycle, right? And it produces a lot of NADHs, for instance, which carry these high energy electrons. And where do those high energy electrons go to? To? There's a metabolic pathway that accepts these high energy electrons that makes a lot of ATP. It is the electron transport chain, or ETC. All right, well, I got off on a little tangent here, but it's probably not a bad idea to review some of that stuff and try to get some pictures in your mind as to what's going on. All right, so back to this astrocyte right here. You see that it has these processes that connect up blood vessels and neurons, and that's for transport of glucose. But the functioning of your brain is so important to maintain homeostasis, which means maintaining what in your body? If you're maintaining homeostasis, you're healthy, right? If you can't maintain homeostasis, what are you? Well, yeah, you're in a disease state and maybe on your way to checking out, right? That could be a very fatal circumstance. So the brain is very, very important, and not anything that is in your blood should have access to your neurons, right? Because there might be toxins in the food that you eat, maybe in some of the chemicals you drink. Maybe one or two people in here would drink something that's toxic to your brain. And there is a structure called the blood-brain barrier that acts like a barrier for many compounds that are in the blood. It prevents them from getting into the brain and affecting these neurons. That's called the blood-brain barrier. And it's the astrocytes, we believe, help determine if that blood-brain barrier is going to develop properly or not, and where it's going to develop. And as a matter of fact, whenever a pharmaceutical company designs a new drug and it's going to work in the brain, what is one of the things that they always have to consider, and they probably have to spend millions of dollars figuring out how to get around it? That is the blood-brain barrier, because we take drugs either intravenously or orally or whatever, they end up in our bloodstream, but that's no guarantee that they can get past the blood-brain barrier into the brain where they're going to perform their function, whether it's a tumor agent or whatever else. Yeah. I can't relate it very easily to stem cell research right at the moment. Okay. So I won't make any comments, but I'll think about that, and maybe we'll come back to that in a little bit. Okay. So there are certain tricks, right, that we have to modify various compounds to get through this blood-brain barrier. But basically, it's a very good function that protects the brain from everything that we have in our blood, which might be harmful to these neurons right here. Another function of an astrocyte is that it's involved with synaptic transmission. It's involved in transferring information from one neuron to another. So here is a junction between neurons, and this is what we call a chemical synapse. There's a chemical that actually has to go from the cell before the synapse that moves across the synapse and stimulates the second cell to develop another electrical signal. And these chemical compounds we call neurotransmitters. And astrocytes sometimes aid in the recovery of these neurotransmitters and the recycling of neurotransmitters back into what we call the presynaptic cell, so that they can be used over and over again, so that we have a nice functional communication between these cells. Okay, so that's another job of an astrocyte. And probably another very important purpose of an astrocyte is that it releases compounds that can regulate the growth, which we call neurogenesis of neurons. It can tell this neuron here to go ahead and branch off and connect up to another neuron someplace. All right, so astrocytes determine the architecture of a network of neurons that are in our brain, and it allows for the remodeling of our brain when we are learning things. So the learning process involves making new connections between neurons, which means neurons have to send different processes to different locations, so the brain actually has to grow when we learn stuff. And we know, for instance, in a particular condition called clinical depression, there's a part of people that have that malady, there's a part of their brain that actually atrophies, right? It actually starts to dissolve away, unfortunately. And with antidepressants, with imaging studies, we see that that part of the brain actually starts to grow back, right? So that's really nice, that clinical depression, right? We have evidence that it can be treated properly, and people can start to feel normal again. Okay, and so that's due to those neurotrophins, right, that we saw on the previous slide. All right, so astrocytes are really, really important. All right, and I talked about the blood-brain barrier already. All right, so please be sure you're aware of all those functions of those support cells in the nervous system. All right, let's get back to the resting membrane potential. So this is just a little review. So all cells act like a battery. They're going to separate charge. And you should know what ions are at a high concentration inside the cell and which are at a high concentration outside the cell. All right, so could anybody tell me what ion is high inside the cell? Potassium. What's the charge on potassium? It's a plus. It's a cation, right? That's how we should properly talk about it. And what ion is high outside the cell? Sodium. And it is a cation as well. Okay, and mostly that sets up because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump, right, is always pumping potassium inside the cell and sodium out, so it generates that gradient of potassium and sodium ions. And as a result, and also as a result of large anions inside the cell, oh, guess what? Is this, we should probably have, oops, we should have anions right here. I can't modify the cell. These are proteins which have a negative charge on them. So the inside of the cell is always going to be a little bit negative compared to the outside. That's the resting membrane potential. Okay. And when we say resting membrane potential, what is the cell doing? Nothing. It's at rest, right? That's what we call a resting membrane potential. The potential isn't changing if the cell isn't doing anything. All right. But that makes cells excitable. Right, if there's a gradient of something, what can you tell me about a gradient? What can you tell me about a gradient? What do you know about a gradient? Okay, that means there is a difference in concentration between two areas. And remember the chemiosmotic theory? What can a gradient be used for? It's really a form of energy. It can be used to do work, right? A gradient can be used to do work. And these gradients in potassium and sodium can be used to transmit information over long distances within a cell because there is energy in that gradient. And that gradient allows neurons and muscles to generate and conduct electrical impulses. We're going to see how that happens. So muscles and neurons do have something in common. They do transmit electrical impulses, but what's the big difference between a neuron and a muscle? Even without taking a physiology class, you know that muscle does what that's different than just a neuron? When it is stimulated electrically, did you ever touch an electrical socket or an electrical appliance and you got shocked? What happened? Your muscles contract, right? So electrical impulses cause muscles to contract. That's something that doesn't happen in neurons, right? A neuron doesn't contract when it is stimulated. All right, so we can measure the membrane potential, and when we say potential, that just means a voltage, that there's a difference in charge. And we can measure that membrane potential by putting one electrode inside the cell and then putting another electrode outside the cell and measure the change or the difference in voltage between these two electrodes. And we can read that voltage on a voltmeter or something, or we can plug it into an oscilloscope and actually look at a graphical form of what that voltage looks like versus time. So this on the oscilloscope we'll see a voltage versus time plot. Okay, so this is just a fancy kind of voltmeter. And if the cell isn't doing anything, an average cell is going to be at what membrane potential? Can you read it off the oscilloscope right here? Minus 70, right? So that is what we call resting membrane potential, and I'm just going to call it RMP. But that RMP can change depending on whether a cell is going to be stimulated or be inhibited, right? If the cell is stimulated, look what happens to RMP. It starts to deviate. It starts to move. And how does it move? How could you describe the motion or the deviation from RMP when a cell is stimulated? How's it moving? It's moving more positive, right? The membrane potential is going from a negative number up towards zero. Right, so in resting condition, the membrane has polarity. Right, it's negative on the inside, positive on the outside. But when it's stimulated, that polarity starts to do what? Starts to go away. It starts to go to zero. We call that depolarization. So when RMP goes from something negative up to zero, it's losing polarity. So we call that depolarization. Other cells, right, can be signaled, and they can actually be inhibited. When RMP deviates, right, it doesn't go to zero, it becomes more and more negative. And we don't call that depolarization because what? The RMP is getting, or the membrane potential is getting greater. We call that hyperpolarization. Hyper meaning what? More polar. There's a bigger difference in voltage between the inside and outside of the cell. And we call that inhibition. We are actually inhibiting the cell when that happens. Okay, so the membrane potential changes, okay, or these changes occur by ion flow through the membrane channels. There are membrane channels that allow these ions to move across, right? And why does, say, potassium need a membrane channel to get through the membrane? What can you tell me about potassium compared to some nice physical chemistry of a cell membrane? What can get through a cell membrane? Only nonpolar compounds, only lipophilic compounds, right? Or hydrophobic compounds can get through the membrane, because what's the inner layer of the membrane made out of? Yeah, it's made out of those fatty acids, which is part of the phospholipid, and those are sticking inside the inner compartment of a cell membrane. So that excludes water, and it excludes ions from moving across the membrane. All right, so some channels are normally open, like these potassium leakage channels, all right, and others are closed at various times. And the closed channels can have molecular gates that can be opened. So the sodium and potassium permeability across a membrane can change depending on conditions on the cell. And one of the conditions, all right, is due to the voltage that is across the membrane. So these we call voltage-gated channels. All right, so voltage-gated channels will be stimulated into opening when the cell membrane depolarizes. All right, and we saw what that looks like. So there are some proteins in the membrane. When the cell moves from RMP up to zero, all of a sudden they open up and they allow ions to move from the outside to the inside of the cell, or from the inside to the outside of the cell. So that's what we call a voltage-gated channel, because they're either opened or closed depending on the voltage across the membrane. The voltage-gated potassium channels are closed in resting cells. Right, and even the sodium channels are closed in resting cells. Right, so there isn't very much potassium moving down the concentration gradient, nor sodium when the cell is at rest. All right, so here is a nice little model of a gated channel. So do you recognize this structure right here? What's the building block that you see repeating over and over and over again? That's a phospholipid, right? So the hydrophilic head groups are pointing to the outside of the cell and into the cytoplasm because that's a watery environment. But on the inside of the membrane, we have that lipid layer. All right, so ions can't move across this particular channel. All right, and what can you tell me about the configuration of this protein right here? Does it look like the channel's open or closed? It looks like it's closed, right? All right. So this would be a pretty good example of, say, maybe a sodium channel. And all of a sudden, let's apply a change the voltage across the membrane. And when we change the voltage across the membrane, that's going to pull and tug on this protein. because it has electrical charges on it, and it's going to change it, change its native configuration, and it's going to allow it to develop a channel or a pore through the middle. So now sodium can actually move from one side of the membrane to the other, because sodium can fit through this channel. Right? And so since this toggles from closed to open due to the voltage across the membrane, we call this a voltage-gated channel. So at resting membrane potential, it's closed, but as soon as depolarization starts to take place, this channel opens up and then sodium can move. So I think I want to tell you a little bit about why sodium is moving. All right, where is sodium at high concentration? Sodium is high outside. Okay. So if we allow sodium to move across the cell membrane, what's the easiest way for sodium to move? It will want to move by diffusion from where? High concentration to low. So sodium, by the concentration gradient, wants to move inside the cell. But what about the electrical gradient? What's the electrical state inside the cell? Is it more negative or more positive when the cell is at rest? It's negative, all right, and sodium is what kind of charge? Is positive. And what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So the electrical gradient is also going to do what for sodium? Move it into the cell. So you got the chemical gradient moving sodium into the cell. You got the electrical gradient moving inside the cell through this channel right here. And when sodium goes to the inside of the cell, it brings with it what kind of charge? A positive charge. What does it do to the negative charge inside the cell? Kind of neutralizes it, right? And so that's what causes even more depolarization of the cell. When positive charges enter, the membrane potential, RMP, disappears, and what do we have? We have this condition right here. We have, when sodium enters, we say the cell is depolarizing. Okay. But then after a short period of time, even though the channel is still open, there's another little protein, and this is just a little representation that you can have in your mind. We can see like a little chain with a bigger bulbous protein right here. After a short period of time, this right here plugs up the channel. Even though the channel is open, all right, once the channel is plugged by this special little gate, we call this an inactivation gate, what happens to the patency of this channel? Even though it's still open, can sodium get through? No. So this is what we call an inactivation gate. It's particular to a sodium channel. And we're going to see what effect this has and how our body operates. All right. So when a voltage is changing during over time of a cell membrane, we can't call that a resting membrane potential. What is a resting membrane potential? It's just a flat line. Okay? But whenever the membrane potential starts to change, all right, that means it's moving. And we call that an action potential. And action potentials are due to voltage-gated channels in a cell membrane someplace. All right, so let's take a look at the figure on the right-hand side. All right, so as a matter of fact, over the weekend, you should probably draw this figure out just from memory, maybe 10 times, okay? And I won't grade it for you, but in lab, I would grade it for you guys. I don't know what you're doing in lab. But this is a really important exam figure. It's so important that you should just be able to draw it from memory. Okay, so what are we looking at here? We're looking at a plot of membrane potential versus time in seconds, right? So we're familiar with seconds. It's kind of short period of time, but not that short a period of time. And minus 70 is what? RMP, and it's labeled on this diagram, you see, resting membrane potential. All right, and if a cell is at rest and we watch it, the membrane potential isn't going to change. But now we're going to stimulate the cell somehow, and I'll talk about how the cell is stimulated in a little bit, okay, maybe next week sometime. But let's stimulate the cell, and what is the phenomena? What do we call the phenomena when a cell is stimulated? What produces stimulation? It is a depolarization. Now, does that look true to this particular figure? You see the trace is moving from minus 70 toward zero. So is that hyperpolarization or is that depolarization? That's depolarization. That's what a stimulus produces. Okay. So the membrane voltage is changing, and it just so happens that the sodium channels in the membrane, when the membrane potential reaches about minus 55 or so, that's enough for this sodium channel to go from a closed position to an open position, like this. All right, and then what happens when the sodium channel opens up? A big concentration gradient for sodium, high on the outside, low on the inside, is going to draw sodium inside the cell. Don't forget, it's still negative inside the cell. So that's going to draw sodium inside the cell. So there's going to be what we call a large sodium current entering the cell. So, and what's the polarity, or what is the charge that's being drawn into the cell? Positive charges. And that does what? That further erases the membrane potential, right? That neutralizes the negative charges inside the cell. So we see as soon as those gates open up, once the stimulus voltage reaches minus 55, those sodium channels open up, and then there's a huge rush of sodium where? From outside to inside the cell, erasing the membrane potential and even driving it a little positive. All right, this is due to a sodium current going in. All right, so can you see what I'm talking about there? Can you follow my discussion? You need a little picture in your mind of what's happening right there. Okay, so this is what we call an action potential, this spike right here. This first part is what we call depolarization, and you have to know what ion is producing it. It's going to be sodium, and you should know which way the motion is sodium going. Is it going from outside to inside or inside to outside? Outside to inside. That is depolarization. That's a very strong stimulus. But this depolarization of an action potential can only occur if there is a proper stimulus, and the stimulus has to reach this threshold level, right? If there's a stimulus and it only produces a depolarization of 5 millivolts, that means that RMP goes from minus 70 to minus 65. Will that produce an action potential?
No,
because it hasn't reached threshold, right? There has to be a threshold, right? And once threshold is reached, then these voltage-gated channels for sodium open up, and there you have this big influx of sodium into the cell, completely depolarizing it. All right. Also, when stimulus is reached, not only are the sodium channels opened up, but potassium channels start to open up as well. So let's look at just this point right here, right at minus 55. All right, so it's still negative on the inside of the cell, right, by minus 55 millivolts. Now, what is potassium going to want to do at this point in time? Okay. It maybe wants to move outside the cell because that's the concentration gradient, right? It's high inside, low outside, so you think, well, potassium actually wants to leave the cell. But don't forget about the membrane potential. The membrane potential is still negative on the inside. Does that electrical charge want to let potassium rush outside the cell? It doesn't, because potassium is a positive charge. It still holds on to potassium. So potassium doesn't leave right away for a couple reasons. The potassium channels are slow to react, all right? So they're told to open, but they're slow. So they open up slowly. But even if they were to open up fast, potassium wouldn't leave because the electrical potential is still holding it inside the cell, all right? But then look what happens over here. As the cell becomes positive on the inside, right, due to this depolarization due to sodium, now it's positive inside the cell. Is the electrical charge inside the cell going to hold on to potassium? No. It's going to allow potassium to leave the cell, right, because now it's really more negative on the outside. The concentration of potassium is high inside. It's low outside. So now potassium is going to leave the cell right at this point right here. So when potassium leaves the cell, what happens to the voltage inside? What kind of ion is potassium? It's a cation. It has a positive charge, and when a positive charge leaves the inside of the cell, what happens to the electrical nature inside? It becomes more negative, right? It's losing positivity, so it becomes more negative, and the membrane potential goes back down, and we call that what? Repolarization as a result of that. And not only are the potassium channels slow to open up, they're slow to close. And because they stay open for a pretty long period of time, we get this little region right here that we call hyperpolarization. There's a little bit of overshoot that occurs right here because the potassium channels are a little bit slow. So we have an action potential characterized by a stimulus, which causes some depolarization, that causes those sodium channels to open up very rapidly. And when they open up, sodium rushes inside the cell because it's flowing down its electrochemical gradient. And then when the polarity of the cell changes, that provides a nice force to allow potassium to leave through potassium channels, which were opened, right, due to this electrical stimulus, and they stay open for a fairly long period of time, causing this little area of hyperpolarization as well. And then eventually the cell gets back to this level right here. What is this level? Right where I have the cursor. That's RMP. And the cell's back at rest again. Okay. So the kinds of membrane proteins that allow this kind of behavior, electrical behavior across the cell membrane, are what we call voltage-gated channels. So voltage-gated channels produce action potentials. All right, so you should be familiar with that one. Okay, we're going to look at some other kinds of channels in a little bit, and they're not voltage-gated, right? But voltage-gated channels produce action potentials. So I think maybe there are four parts to this action potential that you should have on the tip of your tongue. An action potential has to have a threshold stimulus, right? Not just any kind of stimulus. It's got to be threshold. And then there is depolarization, followed by repolarization. And then there's a little overshoot past resting membrane potential, which produces hyperpolarization. Okay, and that hyperpolarization is actually pretty important, okay, for the following reason. And that reason is, all right, what kind of, if threshold is at minus 55, what kind of stimulus is necessary to reach threshold when you're at RMP? You need minus 55, so 55 from 70 is what? 55 from 70 is 15 millivolts, right? So if you got 55 and add 15 to it, right, that's 60 and another 10, that's 70. So you need a 15 millivolt stimulus to produce this action potential when the cell's at RMP. All right, but if you're in this region of hyperpolarization and the cell is going to experience a 15 millivolt stimulus, where does that take the cell membrane voltage to? This looks like maybe it's minus 80. Okay, let's just say it's minus 80. And then if we have a 15 millivolt stimulus, where does it go? It goes to minus 70, and then it goes to minus 65. So it's the same stimulus, but does that produce an action potential? You see that it doesn't produce an action potential because why? It didn't hit the threshold. So that's what we call a sub-threshold stimulus. And this period right here where that same stimulus, which could cause an action potential in the first case, doesn't produce it over here, produces what, a sub-threshold stimulus, we call this a refractory period. So the neuron is not as sensitive to stimuli during this time. It's what's called a refractory period, and that refractory period you see goes away and it has different magnitudes as it's dying away, so we call this a relative refractory period. A relative refractory period can be overcome. What can it be overcome by? And we could actually calculate that particular number. So let's just say, what did we say this was here? Minus 80? What kind of stimulus is needed now to overcome this refractory period? You need 15 plus another 10 millivolts, right? So with a 25 millivolt stimulus, what will be reached? Threshold, and what will happen? another action potential. Okay, so relative refractory periods can be overcome if you have an above normal stimulus on that neuron. Okay, so that's a pretty important thing. All right, one other thing. You might wonder, well, what happens to these sodium channels right here, right at the peak of the action potential? The sodium channels actually very rapidly close. And the rapid closure of the sodium channels is due to this inactivation gate. This inactivation gate slams closed when the membrane potential becomes positive. All right, and when it becomes closed, right at this period of in the action potential right now, can there be any further depolarization of the membrane? No, right? So right at this point in time, the neuron can't be stimulated into producing another action potential. Why is that? Because the sodium channel is closed due to this inactivation gate. So no matter what kind of stimulus is applied to the neuron, even though it could be a supra threshold stimulus, it cannot stimulate another action potential. So action potentials cannot summate. They can't come on top of each other, right? They always have to be separated from each other in time because of that inactivation gate. And the inactivation gate goes away right when the membrane potential crosses over RMP. All right, so this point in time, from the peak of the action potential to when it reaches RMP, that's a refractory period, but it's a refractory period that can never be overcome, so we call that an absolute refractory period. Okay, so absolute refractory period is from the peak to when it reaches RMP, but from RMP during this period of hyperpolarization until it reaches RMP again, this is what we call the relative refractory period. It can be overcome with an additional stimulus, additional magnitude of stimulus. Yeah. Okay. Absolute refractory. Yeah, that's good. That's good. You know, that's an important thing to think of, and I'll be happy to talk about it again. Okay. An absolute refractory period occurs when the sodium channels close completely. All right? Because when sodium channels close completely, what can you tell me about depolarization? Can't happen, all right? And that happens when the inactivation gate for sodium channels close, and it closes right at the peak of an action potential. And on our diagram over here, here is a little illustration of that inactivation gate. Even though the sodium channel through the membrane is open, it still can be plugged up by the inactivation gate. So it goes from, the inactivation gate goes from open to closed, right? It toggles from here to here when? During when the action potential reaches this peak right here. The inactivation gate closes. So the cell can no longer depolarize, no matter what kind of stimulus is applied to it. But the inactivation gate is not on the potassium channel, so potassium can enter the cell, I mean, can leave the cell, and that causes hyperpolarization. Yeah.
So when the cell has a relative refractory period and the actual potential, is that kind of like homeostasis to the
neuron? It's going to regulate, we're going to see the intensity, how information is passed through a neuron and how neurons can tell us about different kinds of intensity of signals. Okay. This relative refractory period over here can be overcome if the stimulus that's applied to a neuron increases. Okay. That was just an example. But if the stimulus intensity increases, then this hyperpolarization can be overcome and another action potential can ensue. Okay, so, yeah.
You said but when the potassium gate is not closed, that creates the depolarization?
Yeah, when those voltage-gated potassium channels are open, that allows potassium to move across the membrane. And it's going to want to go from, by the concentration gradient, from high inside to low outside, right? But if it's negative inside the cell, The cell doesn't want to release the potassium. There's no electrical gradient. But notice here, when the cell depolarizes, the inside of the cell becomes positive, and that actually helps what? Potassium leaves. So potassium moves from inside to outside due to two things. The concentration gradient is favorable, and when the cell is depolarized, the electrical gradient is favorable as well. And that's going to drive potassium out of the cell. And when potassium leaves, it's dragging electrical charge with it. What kind of charge is leaving the cell? A positive charge. And when positive charges leave the cell, the inside becomes more negative, and we call that repolarization. Okay? All right, so something else about this action potential is not only can't we add action potentials together because of this absolute refractory period, action potentials are always going to be the same amplitude, right? They're only going to go to, bless you, they're only going to go to about 30 plus 30 millivolts, no matter how the stimulus changes, right? That's the maximum amplitude of an action potential because potassium is going to start to leave the cell as a result of that. So you might say, well, how is it that our brain can perceive different intensities? So what is the intensity of a waveform? Well, we can look at a wave like a sine wave right here. So this is time. Okay, and then this is just going to be, for instance, a voltage in this dimension right over here. And so here we have a really low level sine wave. If we were going to listen to something like this, it would just sound like what? Very, very soft, because it's low intensity. Okay, but can you hear loud intensity? Can you appreciate different intensity sounds? Okay, I could talk really loud, and what is that going to look like? That's going to look like, right, it's going to have the same frequency, but now the amplitude of this waveform increases, so the amplitude is low A. In the second case, it's what? A lot higher. So you can appreciate intensity, your mind can appreciate intensity, but if the amplitude of an action potential is always the same, how is it that you can appreciate changes in intensity? Okay, and we're going to find out why that is. I can't describe that to you today. But what I want you to know is that an action potential is always the same. It never changes. So your body has to do something different so that you can appreciate low intensity signals and also high intensity signals. But it is not by the shape of an action potential. The action potential is always going to have the same duration, and it's going to have the same amplitude. You just have to look forward to that a little bit later. All right, so here is something that is kind of interesting about an action potential. Remember, we talked about feedback mechanisms once before, and what kinds of feedback mechanisms are there? There's negative and positive. Which one usually produces a disease-free state that results in homeostasis? It's a negative feedback. Yeah, it's a negative feedback, which is a good thing in control system theory, right? It produces homeostasis. Positive feedback drives something farther and farther away from set point, and that usually produces an uncompensated disease state, right? Positive feedback is usually the bad kind of feedback to have. But here is an exception to that particular rule. And that is the action potential. In particular, this depolarization event. Notice how rapid it is. It relies on positive feedback to happen very, very quickly. Okay, so first we have to have a stimulus, some depolarizing stimulus. Haven't talked about that picture yet, but we'll start talking about that pretty soon. What does the stimulus do? What does it produce on this neuron? It produces... what's happening to the membrane potential due to the stimulus? It's depolarizing, right? It's depolarizing. It's changing the membrane voltage. And then when the voltage reaches threshold, what happens? These sodium channels go from closed to open, right? But they don't all open at exactly the same voltage. There's a population of them, right? Some open a little bit sooner when the voltage changes than others. Okay, but as soon as some of these voltage-gated channels open, what happens to the membrane potential when sodium enters the cell? What happens to membrane potential? It depolarizes even more, right? So it depolarizes first due to the stimulus, and then when some of these voltage-gated sodium channels open, then the membrane voltage starts to change very rapidly. All right, and when a few of those voltage-gated channels open and it causes more depolarization of the membrane, look what happens. All right, it causes even more voltage-gated channels to open, which causes what? More sodium to enter the cell. It depolarizes faster, which causes even more voltage-gated channels to open, which causes more sodium to enter the cell, which causes even more voltage-gated channels to open. Right, so this is what? Not negative feedback, that's positive feedback. And as a result of that positive feedback, that causes what? A very rapid depolarization phase of the action potential. Right? But this whole positive feedback mechanism, right, stops. When does it stop? Something changes drastically. What changes drastically right here? The inactivation gate now plugs up the sodium channel and it breaks that positive feedback loop. And then that allows the cell to start to repolarize at that point in time. Okay, so positive feedback can't go forever, right? It usually, something drastic has to happen, and what happens drastically in this case is that inactivation gate closes. Okay. So voltage-gated channels are very important because it can produce these action potentials. All right, so I think I've talked about all this stuff already. Okay, on this slide. Yeah, even this slide right here. So over the weekend, draw this out a couple times, right, so that it's more on the tip of your tongue. All right. All right, but I do want to put another diagram on the board right here. And this is part of the hand-drawn handout that I have in your study guide. All right, this is not a picture from your text. So here we have, who can tell me what this is first? Neuron. All right. I don't even have to draw it, but I'll finish drawing it. All right. So here we have a drawing, neuron. What am I drawing right now? Dendrites. And what did I draw first? A cell body. And then we have the axon like this. And then we got the axon terminus, right? And then we got little synaptic knobs right here, Bouton terminales or whatever. All right. And so there's a cell membrane around this whole neuron. And we just, don't wrinkle your nose like that. That's a beautiful diagram. Oh, you can't see it because the marker is not dark enough, maybe. Is that why? No. Okay. So you got to know the parts of the neuron, right? You got dendrites, you got cell body, you got the axon terminus. And what did we say? How does information flow over this neuron? It starts, okay, either a dendrite or cell body, and it proceeds down an axon. It does not go backwards. And you're going to have to get a feel for why that is, so let's start talking about why that is. We just got done talking about special proteins within the plasma membrane of this kind of cell right here. Oh, what kind of cell is this besides a neuron? It's a multipolar neuron. Multipolar neurons are found where? What's the function of a multipolar neuron? It's a motor neuron. It goes from central nervous system to the periphery. It's also important because it can form interneurons for sharing information within the central nervous system. Okay. And what is this part of the neuron right here? See, it kind of looks like a funnel right there. And actually, you should see it as a funnel, and you're going to think of it as a funnel as well. This is the axon hillock. Oops. A-X-O-N. Axon hillock right here. Okay, so we said that the dendrites are the receiving end of this neuron, and the axon is the sending end. So those voltage-gated channels, which are proteins inside the plasma membrane, we don't find them all over the neuron. We only find them in basically one spot. Okay, and where we start to find them is in the axon hillock. So from the beginning of the axon hillock all the way down past the axon terminals, we have voltage-gated channels. There are no voltage-gated channels, and I'm telling you there might be some exceptions to this rule, but this is a good place to start. There are no voltage-gated channels on dendrites and the cell body. And I could ask you, why is that? Because this part of the axon is what? The sending part, and this is the receiving part. The receiving part. And the receiving end of a neuron does not have any voltage-gated channels. So voltage-gated channels do what for information? They send information. Okay? Because, for instance, when this part of the membrane starts to depolarize, right? So let's just draw a quick little graph. When it starts to depolarize, and if it reaches threshold, an action potential starts, right? So what does that do to the voltage in the neighboring part of the membrane? This action potential causes it to depolarize, and when it reaches threshold, what happens? Action potential, which causes a little depolarization over here, and once it reaches threshold, what happens? Action potential, right? And that goes all the way down, and when it reaches threshold over here, that produces action potential. And what did I say about the amplitude of an action potential? Always the same. Right, so if at the beginning of an axon or the end of the axon or this axon terminus, what is the amplitude of this action potential? It's always the same. That's really a marvelous way of sending information long distances without decrement. Right? We don't really have a method in electrical engineering of doing that same kind of trick. Right? Whenever information is sent through a wire, the information that you put into the wire at the beginning ends up going away by the time it gets to the end. Or if we send a signal from Earth to the moon, what's the amplitude of that signal by the time it gets to the moon? It's really, really tiny. Right? But neurons, because of these voltage-gated channels and axons, don't lose any of that signal, which is kind of amazing because it's using energy in order to send that signal through there. What is the form of that energy? It's due to the sodium and potassium gradients, right? There's energy in those gradients that's developed by those sodium-potassium pumps throughout that whole axon. Okay, so let me see what's on this slide right here. Depolarization and repolarization occur by diffusion, right? So sodium enters the cell basically because of the electrochemical gradient. It's not being pumped in. So it does not require active transport. But after the action potential proceeds along an axon, then the sodium-potassium pump gets the resting membrane potential and the concentration gradients back to normal before the stimulus occurs, right? So the sodium and potassium pumps are necessary to reset everything, but they're not really necessary for the action potential proper. Yeah, I see a question. Information always flows in this direction. So the receiving part, so here's the receiving part right here. Right, these have different kinds of channels in the membrane. We're going to start to look at what some of those are. And then the sending part always has voltage-gated channels. And so because of the nature of these channels, you're going to see that information can only flow from dendrite through the cell body down the axon. Information can't flow backwards. And maybe you get a little glimmer as to why it can't flow backwards because, all right, when there is an action potential here, what is the state of this little segment of axon? Okay, it is depolarized. Right at this point, the inactivation gate closes. So what is the state of this axon right here? It's in an absolute refractory period. Right, it's in an absolute refractory period, and so is this little segment over here, So this action potential can't go backwards. It can only go to an unexcited part of the membrane, which is down toward the axon terminus because of that absolute refractory period. Okay. All right, so it's going to take me a couple days to get a nice model working in your minds for this thing. But if you start working on even labeling that handout over the weekend, that will help you, okay, because it has ascending end, receiving end, the different membrane proteins, all right, that allow that to happen. All right, so let's look at another way of understanding an action potential, all right, by looking at these two graphs right here. We've got two graphs. We got membrane potential versus time. All right, and this is an okay representation of an action potential. What's missing from this diagram is what? The threshold voltage, right, and stimulus, but let's pretend it's in there. All right, so we see that the what do we call this phase right here? That's depolarization of an action potential. That's good. That's going to be worth some points on the test, right? So even if you get that far, that's good, right? So here's depolarization, but you know, if you have a feel for why that happens, that's good. Why is that happening? Sodium is entering the cell, right? Down its electrochemical gradient, that's depolarizing the cell, right? So what species of molecules are causing this depolarization? Well, that's what we see on this second graph over here. So we're actually looking at the sodium and potassium diffusion, or you could think of this as the permeability across the membrane for these two different ions. One is sodium, one is potassium, versus what? Time. And what's the time scale of the second graph compared to the first graph right here? It's exactly the same, right? So you could superimpose these if you wanted to, but we separated them. All right, so we have two different kinds of currents that are causing an action potential. And the first current is due to the motion of sodium, and the second current is caused by the motion of potassium. Right? And these sodium and potassium have to move through voltage-gated channels. Which one is the faster channel to open up? It's a sodium. And you can see that on this lower graph. Right? So here we have the sodium current, and then this one is the potassium current. So you can see sodium opens up very, very rapidly, right? And then so sodium starts to move very rapidly because the permeability is changing. A lot of sodium channels are opening up. And then all of a sudden, the permeability of sodium completely stops. Why is that? Okay. Yeah, you know, the concentration gradient, electrochemical gradient no longer is so favorable. But there's something else that I want you to see here, okay? What happens at this point in time, right here at the peak of the action potential? Okay, has to do with, this inactivation gate closes, right? The inactivation gate closes. And probably some of you heard that, but I think I couldn't hear you. All right, and when does that inactivation gate close? Can you see on the top graph? Boom, right here. Right, and that's just a voltage-controlled event across the membrane, right? So inactivation of the sodium channels begins right here because of that inactivation gate, and that produces, right? What is that? A beige color, right here?
Green.
Green. Okay. Isn't beige and green the same color? Okay. Oh no, beige is a brown color, right? Oh, okay. See, memory. It helps to have a little memory. Okay, so this little light brown color, this beige color right here, all right, is what? Absolute refractory period. Depolarization can't take place any further. Why is that? Because of the inactivation gate is closed. And if I were to draw this diagram, I would draw it out over to here. All right, so it's a little bit sloppy. All right, so that's the sodium current. It goes away because of that inactivation gate. Now, the potassium channels, we can see the permeability of potassium is slower to develop because the potassium channels are a little bit slower compared to the sodium, but also the electrical chemical gradient is not favorable for potassium to leave the cell until the cell does what? Until it actually depolarizes, right? Then it becomes favorable, so then potassium leaves the cell and we can see that it reaches a maximum current or a maximum permeability, okay, right about here, and then that causes this hyperpolarization, and you can see the permeability of potassium is slow to stop because it doesn't have an inactivation gate. That produces this little bit of overshoot below resting membrane potential. And what do we call this area right here besides hyperpolarization? It produces what? A relative refractory period. At this point in time, the membrane can depolarize again, but it needs what? An additional stimulus to reach threshold. It can be overcome if the stimulus intensity is what? Louder, right? Then it can transmit information to the brain. So make sure that you can see an action potential is made up of these two different currents and some events that are happening, right, due to those proteins that are in the membrane. Yeah. So are you interested in this point right here? Okay. Inactivation of potassium channels begins. You know, they just start to close. I don't know if there is really a nice inactivation gate like on the sodium channel. I might have to look that up and see. Okay. But these channels don't stay open indefinitely. Right? They open and close depending on the voltage, and you can see the voltage actually going down right here. That's going to cause the potassium channels to close. Yeah. Yeah, I said that. I might have to eat my words on that one. Okay, but I don't think there is an inactivation gate for potassium. Okay. But they just slowly close on their own as the membrane potential goes back. If it starts to hyperpolarize, the potassium channels just kind of close on their own. Okay. Because if there was a hard inactivation gate for potassium, guess what? I don't think we would get this area of relative refractory period right here, this relative refractory period, if those potassium channels are closed. It would produce what? An absolute refractory period. Okay. Oh, did you learn something different in lab already?
No.
No. Yeah, I'm not sure I can follow your thinking with that. So maybe you see me after class or something. But we got to get that straightened out.
Yeah.
Okay. But the permeability of potassium you can see is what? Decreasing, and that's because the membrane voltage is changing slowly in that area. Okay, it's not due to an inactivation gate. Okay. All right. So let's see, where do we have these voltage-gated channels? What part of the neuron? On the axon, and they start right at that axon hillock. Okay. All right, so this slide right here just kind of reinforces something that I already mentioned, and that is if we look at membrane potential on a neuron, and let's apply various stimuli. And here's the weakest, and then it's a little bit stronger, so the amplitude is a little bit higher, and again, the amplitude or intensity is higher, and then here's finally the strongest one. All right, here we apply a stimulus, but it doesn't stimulate the neuron in producing an action potential. So what would you tell me about this stimulus right here? For sure it's the weakest, but what's a better way of talking about this stimulus? Okay, because the resting membrane potential doesn't change, it never depolarizes, right? So this is what we call a sub-threshold stimulus. A sub-threshold stimulus is one which doesn't reach threshold, so an action potential does not ensue as a result, right? Sub-threshold stimulus. All right, and then what can you tell me about this stimulus right here? Number two, it's strong enough to produce an action potential. And it's the first one as we're increasing intensity, so we call this a threshold stimulus. This is a threshold stimulus. And a threshold stimulus results in what? An action potential. Right? Because right at threshold, then the voltage-gated sodium channels open up, You get that positive feedback mechanism. You get the super rush of sodium inside the cell, and that produces the action potential. All right, well, let me ask you another question about this action potential. What's happening right here at the peak of the action potential? That sodium inactivation gate closes, right? And that doesn't allow any further depolarization of the cell. Now, we come along with another, even stronger stimulus. Okay, so this is above threshold. And what can you tell me about action potential number two over here compared to action potential number one? They look what? They look identical, and indeed they are. They're the same amplitude, same width. Okay, so the stimulus intensity is changing, but what about action potential number three? Same amplitude, same duration. So an action potential doesn't change amplitude or duration as the stimulus intensity changes. But what about your everyday life? Can you tell the difference in intensity as it's changing from low intensity to high intensity? Does your brain appreciate that? Yes, but it's not due to what? Any change in the shape of an action potential. So we're going to have to see why that is sooner or later. Okay. The weakest, I call that a sub-threshold. So if it's a sub-threshold stimulus, let's look at this graph right here. The stimulus produces maybe a little depolarization, but then it dies away before it gets to threshold. So a sub-threshold doesn't produce an action potential. All right, so make sure you know these two phases of an action potential, right? Depolarization, repolarization, and what ions are responsible for them. But you should also be aware of it's got to reach threshold. Also be aware of this area of hyperpolarity right here and what's causing that one. And that you can get from looking at this graph of changing permeabilities across the membrane. Yeah. Action potential is always constant, but the stimulus is going to change as the intensity, for instance, if it's an auditory neuron, as the sound level increases, the stimulus increases, all right? And so that's able to overcome the relative refractory period, okay? As the stimulus increases, the relative refractory period can be overcome, and we're going to see what that means in terms of action potentials. Maybe today. I don't know what's on the next slide. I got to look. Okay. It is on the next slide. All right. Well, how is it that if an action potential can't change in amplitude or duration, how is it that in our minds and brains we can appreciate changes of intensity, in light intensity, sound intensity, or pressure? All right. And that's for the following reason. Okay. So let's look at a number of different stimuli. So here I see three stimuli. We turn it on at a certain point in time and turn it off. We do that three different times, and the length that the stimulus is turned on is exactly the same those three times. But what can you tell me about the intensity of these three stimuli? It is increasing, right? So you can see it's going up in each case. You turn it on and turn it off. So here we apply a first stimulus to this neuron. And what can you tell me about this stimulus right here? If you look at, right, a plot of voltage of the cell. Somebody just had a question on that. We call that a sub-threshold stimulus. All right, so it won't produce an action potential. All right. The second case, we turn a stimulus on and off. And what can you tell me about this stimulus? It is a threshold stimulus because it's producing action potentials. And what about the action potentials that are being produced? Do they have different amplitudes? No, they're all the same. What about the length, the duration? Always the same. But notice how far apart they're spaced. Okay? They're spaced really far apart. Even though the stimulus is still turned on, the reason is, right, once an action potential starts at this point right here, it goes into what? The absolute refractory period. And then there's a period of hyperpolarization, right? And that hyperpolarization means what? That in order to fire another action potential, the stimulus has to be stronger than the first one. But what can you tell me about the stimulus? It's constant, right? So the stimulus isn't changing. So because of that relative refractory period, this stimulus, because it's just threshold, doesn't allow another action potential to fire to come along until what? After that relative refractory period is over. Can you picture what that relative refractory period looks like? Right here. So even though the stimulus is turned on in that second case that we're looking at, it's not strong enough to bring this hyperpolarized membrane up to threshold to cause an action potential until it's way out over here someplace, which means what? There's a big space between this first action potential and the second one, because that threshold stimulus is not strong enough to overcome this relative refractory period. So let's jump to this slide again. So the action potential, same amplitude, same duration, but they're spaced far apart. Now let's look at the third case right here. And this is for sure a threshold stimulus, but it's what? It's even higher than threshold stimulus, right? It's stronger, right? And what can you tell me about these action potentials? What about the amplitude? Still the same. What about the duration? Exactly the same, but what is now different? They are faster in time, right? So we call that the frequency of these action potentials now is happening faster, right? If it's just barely a threshold stimulus, what your brain is actually appreciating is that each of these is just a little blip in your brain. So if it's a low intensity stimulus, your brain is basically experiencing what? A blip, 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 blip. Okay? But as the intensity increases, right, what is your brain experiencing? More blips in a shorter period of time, so it's hearing what? It's experiencing blip, 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 which means to your brain a higher intensity, right? The frequency of these action potentials is faster. We call that frequency coding. Okay?
That the duration and magnitude are constant and that the frequency is directly related to the stimulus?
That's right. So the stimulus intensity is directly related not to the amplitude of an action potential or its duration, but the frequency. So we call that frequency coding. Frequency coding. Because you can experience changes in intensity. Even though the nature of an action potential doesn't change, and the way you do that is because more action potentials get to your brain in a hurry if the intensity of the stimulus is high enough. And why is that? Because this stimulus now is such that it can overcome this relative refractory period. It's high enough now to cause depolarization to reach threshold. And so it's going to happen sooner in time compared to one that can't overcome this relative refractory period. So action potentials will come very rapid in succession if the stimulus is stronger compared to just a threshold stimulus. All right, so on the tip of your tongue, you should also know what that's called. How is intensity coded? By frequency of action potentials, not the amplitude or duration of an action potential. Okay. And as a matter of fact, I talked about this slide, right? Because the higher the stimulus intensity, then the easier it is to overcome this relative refractory period. All right, so this action potential is really kind of a marvelous little device that's used to transmit information. All right, and how is it transmitted down this axon? With decrement or without decrement? Yeah, without. It's an amazing transmission line. Doesn't lose any information. And the other thing maybe some people are kind of looking at is it kind of operates as what? Like a little digital computer. How is it sending information? Either a blip or no blip. Right? That's how computers work. So your brain kind of works partly like a computer and partly as just a regular electrical circuit, which is what we're going to talk about in the next lecture. What happens over here to cause these action potentials? All right, so here's the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Anybody need the sign-in sheet? Fantastic. All right. So start drawing your neuron out that has the different membrane proteins in it, the sending end, receiving end.